This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents City of Illusions by Ursula K. Le Guin. Read by Stefan Rudnicki. One. Imagine darkness. In the darkness that faces outward from the sun, a mute spirit woke. Wholly involved in chaos, he knew no pattern. He had no language, and did not know the darkness to be night. As unremembered light brightened about him, he moved, crawling, running sometimes on all fours, sometimes pulling himself erect, but not going anywhere. He had no way through the world in which he was, for a way implies a beginning and an end. All things about him were tangled. All things resisted him. The confusion of his being was impelled to movement by forces for which he knew no name: terror, hunger, thirst, pain. Through the dark forest of things he blundered in silence, till the night stopped him, a greater force. But when the light began again, he groped on. When he broke out into the sudden broad sunlight of the clearing, he rose upright and stood a moment. Then he put his hands over his eyes and cried out aloud. Weaving at her loom in the sunlit garden, Parth saw him at the forest's edge. She called to the others with a quick beat of her mind, but she feared nothing. And by the time the others came out of the house, she had gone across the clearing to the uncouth figure that crouched among the high, ripe grasses. As they approached, they saw her put her hand on his shoulder and bend down to him, speaking softly. She turned to them with a wondering look, saying, "Do you see his eyes?" They were strange eyes, surely. The pupil was large. The iris, of a grayed amber color, was oval lengthwise, so that the white of the eye did not show at all. "Like a cat," said Gara. "Like an egg, all yolk," said Kai, voicing the slight distaste of uneasiness roused by that small essential difference. Otherwise, the stranger seemed only a man. Under the mud and scratches and filth he had got over his face and naked body in his aimless struggle through the forest. At most, he was a little paler-skinned than the brown people who now surrounded him, discussing him quietly as he crouched in the sunlight, cowering and shaking with exhaustion and fear. Though Parth looked straight into his strange eyes, no spark of human recognition met her there. He was deaf to their speech and did not understand their gestures. "Mindless, or out of his mind," said Zove, "but also starving. We can remedy that." At this, Kai and young Thuro half-led, half-dragged the shambling fellow into the house. There they and Parth and Buckeye managed to feed and clean him, and got him onto a pallet with a shot of sleep dope in his veins to keep him there.
"Is he a Shing?" Parth asked her father.
"Are you? Am I?" "Don't be naive, my dear," Zove answered. "If I could answer that question, I could set Earth free. However, I hope to find out if he's mad or sane or imbecile, and where he came from and how he came by those yellow eyes.
Have men taken to breeding with cats and falcons in humanity's degenerate old age? Ask Cretien to come up to the sleeping porches, daughter."
Parth followed her blind cousin Cretien up the stairs to the shady, breezy balcony where the stranger slept. Zove and his sister Carol, called Buckeye, were waiting there. Both sat cross-legged and straight-backed, Buckeye playing with her patterning frame, Zove doing nothing at all. A brother and sister getting on in years, their broad brown faces alert and very tranquil. The girls sat down near them without breaking the easy silence. Parth was a reddish-brown color with a flood of long, bright black hair. She wore nothing but a pair of loose, silvery breeches. Cretien, a little older, was dark and frail. A red band covered her empty eyes and held her thick hair back. Like her mother, she wore a tunic of delicately woven, figured cloth. It was hot. Midsummer afternoon burned on the gardens below the balcony and out on the rolling fields of the clearing. On every side, so close to this wing of the house as to shadow it with branches full of leaves and wings, so far in other directions as to be blued and hazed by distance, the forest surrounded them. The four people sat still for quite a while, together and separate, unspeaking but linked.
"The amber bead keeps slithering off into the vastness pattern," Buckeye said with a smile, setting down her frame with its jewel-strung crossing wires.
"All your beads end up in vastness," her brother said, "an effect of your suppressed mysticism. You'll end up like our mother, see if you don't, able to see the patterns on an empty frame."
"Suppressed fiddle-diddle," Buckeye remarked. "I never suppressed anything in my life."
"Cretien," said Zove, "the man's eyelids move. He may be in a dreaming cycle."
The blind girl moved closer to the pallet. She reached out her hand, and Zove guided it gently to the stranger's forehead. They were all silent again. All listened, but only Cretien could hear. She lifted her bowed, blind head at last.
"Nothing," she said, her voice a little strained.
"Nothing?"
"A jumble. A void. He has no mind."
"Cretien, let me tell you how he looks. His feet have walked, his hands have worked. Sleep and the drug relax his face, but only a thinking mind could use and wear a face into these lines."
"How did he look when he was awake?"
"Afraid," said Parth. "Afraid. Bewildered."
"He may be an alien," Zove said. "Not a Terran man, though how that could be. But he may think differently than we. Try once more while he still dreams."
"I'll try, Uncle. But I have no sense of any mind, of any true emotion or direction. A baby's mind is frightening, but this is worse. Darkness, and a kind of empty jumble."
"Well, then keep out," Zove said easily. "No mind is an evil place for mind to stay."
"His darkness is worse than mine," said the girl. "This is a ring on his hand."
She had laid her hand a moment on the man's in pity, or as if asking his unconscious pardon for her eavesdropping on his dreams.
"Yes, a gold ring without marking or design. It was all he wore on his body, and his mind stripped naked as his flesh. So the poor brute comes to us out of the forest, sent by whom?"
All the family of Zove's house, except the little children, gathered that night in the great hall downstairs, where high windows stood open to the moist night air. Starlight and the presence of trees and the sound of the brook all entered into the dimly lit room, so that between each person and the next, and between the words they said, there was a certain space for shadows, night wind, and silence.
"Truth, as ever, avoids the stranger," the master of the house said to them in his deep voice. This stranger brings us a choice of several unlikelihoods. He may be an idiot born, who blundered here by chance. But then, who lost him? He may be a man whose brain has been damaged by accident, or tampered with by intent. Or he may be a shing, masking his mind behind a seeming amentia. Or he may be neither man nor shing. But then, what is he? There's no proof or disproof for any of these notions. What shall we do with him?
See if he can be taught, said Zove's wife, Rosa.
The master's eldest son, Metok, spoke. If he can be taught, then he is to be distrusted. He may have been sent here to be taught, to learn our ways, insights, secrets. The cat brought up by the kindly mice.
I am not a kindly mouse, my son, the master said. Then you think him a shing?
Or their tool?
We are all tools of the shing.
What would you do with him?
Kill him before he wakes.
The wind blew faintly. A whippoorwill called out in the humid, starlit clearing.
I wonder, said the oldest woman, if he might be a victim, not a tool. Perhaps the shing destroyed his mind as punishment for something he did or thought. Should we, then, finish their punishment?
It would be truer mercy, Metok said.
Death is a false mercy, the oldest woman said bitterly.
So they discussed the matter back and forth for some while, equably, but with a gravity that included both moral concern and a heavier, more anxious care, never stated but only hinted at whenever one of them spoke the word shing. Parth took no part in the discussion, being only 15, but she listened intently. She was bound by sympathy to the stranger and wanted him to live. Rania and Kretjan joined the group. Rania had been running what physiological tests she could on the stranger, with Kretjan standing by to catch any mental response. They had little to report as yet, other than that the stranger's nervous system and the sense areas and basic motor capacity of his brain seemed normal, though his physical responses and motor skill compared with those of a year-old child, perhaps, and no stimulus of localities in the speech area had got any response at all.
A man's strength, a baby's coordination, an empty mind, Rania said. If we don't kill him like a wild beast, said Bakai, then we shall have to tame him like a wild beast.
Kretjan's brother, Kai, spoke up.
It seems worth trying. Let some of us younger ones have charge of him. We'll see what we can do. We don't have to teach him the inner canons right away, after all. At least teaching him not to wet the bed comes first. I want to know if he's human. Do you think he is, Master?
Zove spread out his big hands.
Who knows? Rania's blood tests may tell us. I never heard that any Shing had yellow eyes or any visible differences from Terran men. But if he is neither Shing nor human, what is he? No being from the other worlds that once were known has walked on Earth for 1,200 years. Like you, Kai, I think I would risk his presence here among us out of pure curiosity.
So they let their guest live. At first he was little trouble to the young people who looked after him. He regained strength slowly, sleeping much, sitting or lying quietly most of the time he was awake. Parth named him Falk, which in the dialect of the Eastern Forest meant yellow, for his sallow skin and opal eyes. One morning, several days after his arrival, coming to an unpatterned stretch in the cloth she was weaving, she left her sun-powered loom to purr away by itself down in the garden and climbed up to the screened balcony where Falk was kept. He did not see her enter. He was sitting on his pallet, gazing intently up at the haze-dimmed summer sky.
The glare made his eyes water, and he rubbed them vigorously with his hand. Then, seeing his hand, stared at it, the back and the palm. He clenched and extended the fingers, frowning. Then he raised his face again to the white glare of the sun and slowly, tentative, reached his open hand up towards it.
"That's the sun, Falk," Parth said. "Sun."
"Sun," he repeated, gazing at it, centered on it, the void and vacancy of his being filled with the light of the sun and the sound of its name. So his education began. Parth came up from the cellars and, passing through the old kitchen, saw Falk hunched up in one of the window bays alone, watching the snow fall outside the grimy glass. It was a ten-night now since he had struck Rossa, and they had to lock him up till he calmed down. Ever since then he had been dour and would not speak. It was strange to see his man's face dulled and blunted by a child's sulky, obstinate suffering.
"Come on in by the fire, Falk," Parth said, but did not stop to wait for him.
In the great hall by the fire she did wait a little, then gave him up and looked for something to raise her own low spirits. There was nothing to do. The snow fell. All the faces were too familiar. All the books told of things long ago and far away that were no longer true. All around the silent house and its fields lay the silent forest, endless, monotonous, indifferent. Winter after winter, and she would never leave this house, for where was there to go? What was there to do? On one of the empty tables, Rania had left her tiamb, a flat-keyed instrument said to be of Hainish origin. Parth picked out a tune in the melancholic, stepped mode of the eastern forest, then retuned the instrument to its native scale and began anew. She had no skill with the tiamb, and found the notes slowly, singing the words, spinning them out to keep the melody going as she sought the next note. Beyond the sound of wind in trees, beyond the storm and shadowed seas, on stairs of sunlit stone the fair daughter of Irek stands. She lost the tune, then found it again, stands, silent, with empty hands. A legend, who knew how old, from a world incredibly remote, its words and tune had been part of man's heritage for centuries. Parth sang on very softly, alone in the great firelit room, snow and twilight darkening the windows. There was a sound behind her, and she turned to see Falk standing there. There were tears in his strange eyes. He said, "Parth, stop." "Falk, what's wrong?" "It hurts me," he said, turning away his face that so clearly revealed the incoherent and defenseless mind. "What a compliment to my singing," she teased him. But she was moved, and sang no more. Later that night she saw Falk stand by the table on which the tiamb lay. He raised his hand to it, but dared not touch it, as if fearing to release the sweet, relentless demon within it that had cried out under Parth's hands and changed her voice to music. "My child learns faster than yours," Parth said to her cousin Gara. "But yours grows faster, fortunately." "Yours is quite big enough," Gara agreed, looking down across the kitchen garden to the brookside where Falk stood with Gara's year-old baby on his shoulder. The early summer afternoon sang with the shrilling of crickets and gnats. Parth's hair clung in black locks to her cheeks as she tripped and reset and tripped the catches of her loom. Above her patterning shuttle rose the heads and necks of a row of dancing herons, silver thread on gray. At 17, she was the best weaver among the women. In winter, her hands were always stained with the chemicals of which her threads and yarns were made,
and the dyes that colored them, and all summer she wove at her sun-powered loom the delicate and various stuff of her imagination. "Little spider," said her mother nearby, "a joke is a joke, but a man is a man."
"And you want me to go along with Metok to Cathal's house and trade my heron tapestry for a husband?
I know," said Parth.
"I never said it, did I?" inquired her mother, and went weeding on away between the lettuce rows.
Falk came up the path, the baby on his shoulder, squinting in the glare and smiling benignly. He put her down on the grass and said, as if to a grown person, "It's hotter up here, isn't it?" Then, turning to Parth with the grave candor that was characteristic of him, he asked, "Is there an end to the forest, Parth?"
"So they say. The maps are all different, but that way lies the sea, at least,
and that way the prairie."
"Prairie?" "Open lands, grasslands, like the clearing, but going on for 1,000 miles to the mountains."
"The mountains?" he asked, innocently relentless as any child.
"High hills, with snow on their tops all year. Like this."
Pausing to reset her shuttle, Parth put her long, round, brown fingers together in the shape of a peak. Falk's yellow eyes lit up suddenly, and his face became intense.
"Below the white is blue, and below that the lines, the hills far away."
Parth looked at him, saying nothing.
A great part of all he knew had come straight from her, for she had always been the one who could teach him. The remaking of his life had been an effect and a part of the growth of her own. Their minds were very closely interwoven.
"I see it, have seen it, I remember it," the man stammered.
"A projection, Falk?"
"No, not from a book. In my mind, I do remember it. Sometimes going to sleep, I see it. I don't know its name, the mountain."
"Can you draw it?"
Kneeling beside her, he sketched quickly in the dust the outline of an irregular cone, and beneath it two lines of foothills. Gara craned to see the sketch, asking,
"And it's white with snow?"
"Yes. It's as if I see it through something, a big window, big and high up."
"Is it from your mind, Parth?" he asked a little anxiously.
"No," the girl said. "None of us in the house have ever seen high mountains. I think there are none this side of the inland river. It must be far from here, very far."
She spoke like one on whom a chill had fallen.
Through the edge of dreams, a sawtooth sound cut, a faint, jagged droning, eerie. Falk roused and sat up beside Parth. Both gazed with strained, sleepy eyes northward, where the remote sound throbbed and faded, and first light paled the sky above the darkness of the trees.
"An air car," Parth whispered. "I heard one once before, long ago."
She shivered. Falk put his arm around her shoulders, gripped by the same unease, the sense of a remote, uncomprehended, evil presence passing off there in the north through the edge of daylight. The sound died away. In the vast silence of the forest, a few birds piped up for the sparse dawn chorus of autumn. Light in the east brightened. Falk and Parth lay back down in the warmth and the infinite comfort of each other's arms. Only half-wakened, Falk slipped back into sleep. When she kissed him and slipped away to go about the day's work, he murmured, "Don't go yet, little hawk, little one." But she laughed and slipped away, and he drowsed on a while, unable as yet to come up out of the sweet, lazy depths of pleasure and of peace. The sun shone bright and level in his eyes.
He turned over, then sat up, yawning, and stared into the deep, red-leaved branches of the oak that towered up beside the sleeping porch. He became aware that in leaving, Parth had turned on the sleep teacher beside his pillow. It was muttering softly away, reviewing Cetian number theory. That made him laugh, and the cold of the bright November morning woke him fully. He pulled on his shirt and breeches, heavy, soft, dark cloth of Parth's weaving, cut and fitted for him by Buckeye, and stood at the wooden rail of the porch looking across the clearing to the brown and red and gold of the endless trees. Fresh, still, sweet, the morning was as it had been when the first people on this land had waked in their frail pointed houses and stepped outside to see the sun rise free of the dark forest. Mornings are all one, and autumn always autumn. But the years men count are many. There had been a first race on this land, and a second, the conquerors. Both were lost, conquered and conquerors, millions of lives, all drawn together to a vague point on the horizon of past time. The stars had been gained and lost again. Still, the years went on, so many years that the forest of archaic times, destroyed utterly during the era when men had made and kept their history, had grown up again. Even in the obscure, vast history of a planet, the time it takes to make a forest counts. It takes a while. And not every planet can do it. It is no common effect, that tangling of the sun's first cool light in the shadow and complexity of innumerable wind-stirred branches. Falk stood rejoicing in it, perhaps the more intensely because for him, behind this morning there were so few other mornings, so short a stretch of remembered days between him and the dark. He listened to the remarks made by a chickadee in the oak, then stretched, scratched his head vigorously, and went off to join the work and company of the house. Zove's house was a rambling, towering, intermitted chalet castle farmhouse of stone and timber. Some parts of it had stood a century or so, some longer. There was a primitiveness to its aspect. Dark staircases, stone hearths and cellars, bare floors of tile or wood, but nothing in it was unfinished. It was perfectly fireproof and weatherproof, and certain elements of its fabric and function were highly sophisticated devices or machines, the pleasant yellowish fusion lights, the libraries of music, words, and images, various automatic tools or devices used in house cleaning, cooking, washing, and farm work, and some subtler and more specialized instruments kept in workrooms in the east wing. All these things were part of the house, built into it or along with it, made in it or in another of the forest houses. The machinery was heavy and simple, easy to repair. Only the knowledge behind its power source was delicate and irreplaceable. One type of technological device was notably lacking. The library evinced a skill with electronics that had become practically instinctive. The boys liked to build little tellies to signal one another with from room to room. But there was no television, telephone, radio, telegraph, transmitting or receiving beyond the clearing. There were no instruments of communication over distance. There were a couple of homemade air cushion sliders in the east wing, but again they featured mainly in the boys' games. They were hard to handle in the woods on wilderness trails. When people went to visit and trade at another house, they went afoot, perhaps on horseback if the way was very long. The work of the house and farm was light, no hard burden to anyone. Comfort did not rise above warmth and cleanliness, and the food was sound but monotonous. Life in the house had the drab levelness of communal existence, a clean, serene frugality.
Serenity and monotony rose from isolation. 44 people lived here together. Cathal's house, the nearest, was nearly 30 miles to the south. Around the clearing, mile after mile uncleared, unexplored, indifferent, the forest went on. The wild forest, and over it the sky. There was no shutting out the inhuman here, no narrowing man's life as in the cities of earlier ages to within man's scope. To keep anything at all of a complex civilization intact here among so few was a singular and very perilous achievement, though to most of them it seemed quite natural. It was the way one did. No other way was known. Falk saw it a little differently than did the children of the house, for he must always be aware that he had come out of that immense, unhuman wilderness, as sinister and solitary as any wild beast that roamed it, and that all he had learned in Zove's house was like a single candle burning in a great field of darkness. At breakfast, bread, goat's milk, cheese, and brown ale, Metok asked him to come with him to the deer blinds for the day. That pleased Falk. The elder brother was a very skillful hunter, and he was becoming one himself. It gave him and Metok at last a common ground. But the master intervened. "Take Kai today, my son. I want to talk with Falk." Each person of the household had his own room for a study or workroom, and to sleep in freezing weather. Zove's was small, high, and light, with windows west and north and east, looking across the stubble and fallow of the autumnal fields to the forest. The master said, "Parth first saw you there, near that copper beach, I think, 5.5 years ago. A long time. Is it time we talked?"
"Perhaps it is, master," Falk said, diffident.
"It's hard to tell, but I guessed you to be about 25 when you first came. What have you now of those 25 years?"
Falk held out his left hand a moment. "A ring," he said.
"And the memory of a mountain?"
"The memory of a memory," Falk shrugged. "And often, as I've told you, I find for a moment in my mind the sound of a voice or the sense of a motion, a gesture, a distance. These don't fit into my memories of my life here with you, but they make no whole.
They have no meaning."
Zove sat down in the window seat and nodded for Falk to do the same. "You had no growing to do. Your gross motor skills were unimpaired. But even given that basis, you have learned with amazing quickness. I've wondered if the Shing, in controlling human genetics in the old days and weeding out so many as colonists, were selecting us for docility and stupidity, and if you spring from some mutant race that somehow escaped control. Whatever you were a highly intelligent man, and now you are one again. And I should like to know what you yourself think about your mysterious past."
Falk was silent a minute. He was a short, spare, well-made man. His very lively and expressive face just now looked rather somber or apprehensive, reflecting his feelings as candidly as a child's face. At last, visibly summoning up his resolution, he said, "While I was studying with Rania this past summer, she showed me how I differ from the human genetic norm. It's only a twist or two of a helix, a very small difference, like the difference between way and O." Zove looked up with a smile at the reference to the canon which fascinated Falk, but the younger man was not smiling. "However, I am unmistakably not human, so I may be a freak, or a mutant, accidental or intentionally produced, or an alien. I suppose, most likely, I am an unsuccessful genetic experiment, discarded by the experimenters. There's no telling. I'd prefer to think I'm an alien, from some other world. It would mean that at least I'm not the only creature of my kind in the universe. What makes you sure there are other populated worlds? Falk looked up, startled, going at once with a child's credulity, but a man's logic, to the conclusion. Is there reason to think the other worlds of the League were destroyed?
Is there reason to think they ever existed?
So you taught me yourself, and the books, the histories.
You believed them? You believe all we tell you?
What else can I believe? He flushed red. Why would you lie to me?
We might lie to you day and night about everything, for either of two good reasons. Because we are Shing, or because we think you serve them.
There was a pause. And I might serve them and never know it, Falk said, looking down.
Possibly, said the Master. You must consider that possibility, Falk. Among us, Metak has always believed you to be a programmed mind, as they call it. But all the same, he's never lied to you. None of us has, knowingly. The river poet said 1,000 years ago, "In truth, manhood lies." Zove rolled the words out oratorically, then laughed. Double-tongued, like all poets. Well, we've told you what truths and facts we know, Falk. But perhaps not all the guesses and the legends, the stuff that comes before the facts.
How could you teach me those?
We could not. You learned to see the world somewhere else, some other world, maybe. We could help you become a man again, but we could not give you a true childhood. That one has only once.
I feel childish enough among you, Falk said with a somber ruefulness.
You're not childish. You are an inexperienced man. You are a cripple, because there is no child in you, Falk. You are cut off from your roots, from your source. Can you say that this is your home?
No, Falk answered, wincing. Then he said, I have been very happy here. The Master paused a little, but returned to his questioning.
Do you think our life here is a good one, that we follow a good way for men to go?
Yes.
Tell me another thing. Who is our enemy?
The Shing.
Why?
They broke the League of All Worlds, took choice and freedom from men, wrecked all man's works and records, stopped the evolution of the race. They are tyrants and liars.
But they don't keep us from leading our good life here.
We're in hiding. We live apart, so that they'll let us be. If we tried to build any of the great machines, if we gathered in groups or towns or nations to do any great work together, then the Shing would infiltrate and ruin the work and disperse us. I tell you only what you told me, and I believed, Master.
I know. I wondered if behind the fact you had perhaps sensed the legend, the guess, the hope.
Falk did not answer.
We hide from the Shing. We also hide from what we were. Do you see that, Falk? We live well in the houses, well enough, but we are ruled utterly by fear. There was a time we sailed in ships between the stars, and now we dare not go 100 miles from home. We keep a little knowledge and do nothing with it. But once we used that knowledge to weave the pattern of life like a tapestry across night and chaos, we enlarged the chances of life. We did man's work.
After another silence, Zove went on, looking up into the bright November sky.
Consider the worlds, the various men and beasts on them, the constellations of their skies, the cities they built, their songs and ways. All that is lost to us, as utterly as your childhood is lost to you. What do we really know of the time of our greatness? A few names of worlds and heroes, a ragtag of facts we've tried to patch into a history. The Xing Law forbids killing, but they killed knowledge. They burned books, and what may be worse, they falsified what was left. They slipped in the lie, as always. We aren't sure of anything concerning the age of the League. How many of the documents are forged? You must remember, you see, we're in the Xing are our enemy. It's easy enough to live one's whole life without ever seeing one of them, knowingly. At most, one hears an air car passing by far away. Here in the forest, they let us be, and it may be the same now all over the earth, though we don't know. They let us be so long as we stay here, in the cage of our ignorance and the wilderness, bowing when they pass by above our heads. But they don't trust us. How could they? Even after 1,200 years, there is no trust in them, because there is no truth in them. They honor no compact, break any promise, perjure, betray, and lie inexhaustibly. And certain records from the time of the fall of the League hint that they could mind lie. It was the lie that defeated all the races of the League and left us subject to the Xing. Remember that, Falk. Never believe the truth of anything the enemy has said.
I will remember, Master, if I ever meet the enemy.
You will not, unless you go to them.
The apprehensiveness in Falk's face gave way to a listening, still look. What he had been waiting for had arrived.
"You mean leave the house," he said.
"You have thought of it yourself," Zove said as quietly.
"Yes, I have. But there is no way for me to go. I want to live here. Parth and I..."
He hesitated, and Zove struck in, incisive and gentle.
"I honor the love grown between you and Parth, your joy and your fidelity. But you came here on the way to somewhere else, Falk. You are welcome here. You have always been welcome. Your partnership with my daughter must be childless. Even so, I have rejoiced in it. But I do believe that the mystery of your being and your coming here is a great one, not lightly to be put aside. That you walk a way that leads on, that you have work to do."
"What work? Who can tell me?"
"What was kept from us and stolen from you, the Xing will have. That you can be sure of."
There was an aching, scathing bitterness in Zove's voice that Falk had never heard.
"Will those who speak no truth tell me the truth for the asking? And how will I recognize what I seek when I find it?"
Zove was silent a little while, and then said with his usual ease and control,
"I cling to the notion, my son, that in you lies some hope for man. I do not like to give up that notion, but only you can seek your own truth, and if it seems to you that your way ends here, then that perhaps is the truth."
"If I go," Falk said abruptly, "will you let Parth go with me?"
"No, my son."
A child was singing down in the garden. Gara's 4-year-old, turning inept somersaults on the path and singing shrill, sweet nonsense. High up in the long wavering V of the great migrations, skein after skein of wild geese went over southward.
"I was to go with Metok and Thurow to fetch home Thurow's bride," Falk said. "We planned to go soon, before the weather changes. If I go, I'll go on from Rancifel House."
"In winter?"
"There are houses west of Rancifel, no doubt, where I can ask shelter if I need it."
He did not say, and Zove did not ask, why west was the direction he would go.
"There may be, I don't know.
I don't know if they would give shelter to strangers as we do. If you go, you will be alone, and must be alone. Outside this house there is no safe place for you on earth." He spoke, as always, absolutely truthfully, and paid the cost of truth in self-control and pain. Falk said with quick reassurance, "I know that, Master. It's not safety I'd regret. I will tell you what I believe about you. I think you came from a lost world. I think you were not born on Earth. I think you came here, the first alien to return in 1,000 years or more, bringing us a message or a sign. The Shing stopped your mouth and turned you loose in the forests so that none might say they had killed you. You came to us. If you go, I will grieve and fear for you, knowing how alone you go. But I will hope for you, and for ourselves. If you had words to speak to men, you'll remember them in the end. There must be hope, a sign. We cannot go on like this forever." "Perhaps my race was never a friend of mankind," Falk said, looking at Zov with his yellow eyes. "Who knows what I came here to do?" "You'll find those who know. And then you'll do it. I don't fear it. If you serve the enemy, so do we all. All's lost, and nothing's to lose. If not, then you have what we men have lost, a destiny. And in following it, you may bring hope to us all."